Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. 2 years ago this month, Boston's airwaves were filled with voices like these.
Est-ce que la plus bon qui retourne en Haïti?
Oui, les plus bon qui vont retourner en Haïti.
It's way better to stay here than Haiti because everything that I had was destroyed. And I still do not know whether or not my husband is alive.
I have brothers, sisters, cousins. And when the earthquake happened, I had a family of 12 that passed.
Fabian Eliasson and Marie Honoré were just two of the millions of people whose lives were shattered by the massive earthquake that leveled Haiti on January 12th, 2010. Marie came to Boston shortly after the quake. Fabian is a longtime member of Boston's Haitian community, the third largest in the United States.
The earthquake killed almost a quarter of a million people. It was called the single largest natural catastrophe in Haiti's 200-year history. Aid flooded into the tiny nation. But it wasn't long before a new generation of outside observers began resurrecting old stereotypes about Haiti.
Poor, benighted, politically unstable, even irredeemable. These are the judgments passed on Haiti by its powerful Western neighbors. They are also the product of what Laurent Dubois calls the aftershocks of history itself. Dubois is a professor of French studies and history at Duke University, and his new book is Haiti, the Aftershocks of History. He joins us today from the Duke campus in Durham, North Carolina. Professor Dubois, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you, you know, you sort of open your book reminding us of the commentary that was coming out of Haiti in those terrible days and weeks after the 2010 earthquake. Just to remind listeners of a few, I mean, they can remember the, you know, the dirty T-shirt and furrowed brow of Anderson Cooper of CNN looking across, you know, a moonscape of destruction and reminding everyone that Haiti was the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Then there was Pat Robertson, who claimed that the Haitians were suffering because they'd sold themselves to the devil, and even David Brooks in the New York Times calling Haiti a progress-resistant culture or progress-resistant cultural influences running amok in Haiti. I mean, basically, the idea was that after that earthquake, here was a nation that was once again outside the bounds of civilization. But you remind us that these are opinions of Haiti that date centuries. At what point do they first emerge?
Well, in a sense, they really emerge from the very beginning of Haiti's existence. This is a country founded through a revolution of the enslaved against a system of slavery. And powerful neighbors from that time on, I think, often demonized the country. And what was striking after the earthquake, I think, is that we're a country that's had very, very close relationships with Haiti for the last 200 years, played a very important role in its history. And yet, in many ways, we know very little about the country. And that's something I try to address and in a sense, redress in writing the book.
Well, in fact, when Haiti was it was a colony of the French in the 18th century. At that point in time, I believe it was one of the most lucrative on earth. It's astounding. A third of the world's sugar and half of the world's coffee was produced from Haiti?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a true economic powerhouse, really the most profitable colony in the Americas, one of the most profitable probably in the history of the world. That was based on a very, very brutal system, the exploitation of slave labor, and a massive number of slaves were brought into the country. Large numbers died. And the plantation regime is what they rose up against in 1791.
So 1791, that is the date which, if I may stretch the metaphor a little, serves as the epicenter for Haitian, the earthquake of Haitian political and social history that reverberated around the world at that time. Basically, Haiti was the home of the world's largest successful slave revolt. What happened?
Well, in 1791, they rose up en masse in the northern plain of Saint-Domingue on these sugar plantations. And what's remarkable is that they were able to consolidate that revolution. And little by little, they gained allies. They had military successes. And over time, really rather quickly, in fact, by 1793, they had forced the French to abolish slavery in Saint-Domingue. And that became then policy of the French Republic throughout its empire. So it took a very quick 2 years to overthrow a system that seemed unchangeable, perhaps, at the beginning of that revolution.
Well, what happened to the Haitians themselves who, it must have come at great cost to them. It was not a blood-free revolution.
Well, no, it was very violent at the beginning, but in a sense, the most violent period came later. There was after this emancipation, there was a period during which freedom was put into place, and there was actually really even an alliance between the French Republic and these ex-slaves. But then Napoleon came to power in the early 1800s and decided to reverse that process, and it's the War for Independence of Haiti, which culminated in 1804, which became very, very violent.
Well, I want to get into some detail about that, and actually also what happened in the subsequent years, because it's shocking once the history is revealed to you. But I have to ask you: you make a point of saying in the new book that basically the Haitian Revolution, the uprising of slaves in this incredibly important colony, was immediately seen by its neighbors, including the United States and all other colonial powers, as a huge threat. That Haiti at its birth was a threat to other countries. Why is that?
Well, simply because all these other countries essentially were also built on foundations of slavery. Certainly the United States, many of the Spanish colonies nearby, Jamaica, all of them completely depended on slaves being submissive to the regime and not resisting. So the example of successful resistance was really a deeply threatening thing.
And it would be, at least in the United States case, another 6 decades before the Civil War would come around.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
From the historical standpoint, it happened so much earlier than the Civil War here that it's a remarkable story. But before we go any further, I want to throw some questions open to our listeners who might be tuning in. We are talking about Haiti and how its history continues to really shake the nation, even as it tries to rebuild after the earthquake of 2 years ago, and also the history of repeated American and foreign intervention in Haiti and how that's affected the country and the diaspora, which spreads all the way here to Boston, the third largest Haitian American community in the country. My guest is Laurent Dubois. He is a professor at Duke University, and his new book is Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. So listeners, when you hear that the United States was very resistant to the idea of a free and slave-free Haiti in 1791 and even 1804, what do you make of that? Has the deck always been stacked against Haiti? And what effect does that history have on U.S.-Haiti relations now? And if you've got family members in Haiti, what are they telling you? What does the country need? What are its challenges? And how can Haiti withstand these aftershocks of history? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Before we leave the issue of Haitian independence entirely, Professor Dubois, I want to ask you, there were some direct consequences in terms of the social psychology of the country because of the way the nation was born. I mean, you point out that this was a nation of slaves who then freed themselves, but they never had any direct experience of what democracy is or how it should function, and that's played itself out through history. How?
Well, in a sense, it's true, right? They were on the plantations and they had not had that experience. But actually, the process of the revolution itself did provide some basic strategies for democracy. So they had organized in military fashion and in a kind of social movement during that revolution. But they certainly essentially had to create new institutions out of whole cloth in a way. And trying to invent new institutions was a big challenge, especially given how much hostility there was towards their nascent country in 1804.
And in fact, the old institutions, i.e. the plantations that were such incredible money-making operations, members of the even then nascent Haitian elite looked at the plantations as the country's economic salvation.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. There were leaders, including Toussaint Louverture, who thought essentially that was the only option for the country, was to continue to operate with plantations. And they didn't believe in slavery, but they believed in other forms of kind of coercing labor. But the majority of the population had a very, very different vision of what their future was to look like.
And what was that vision? And was any of it ever enacted?
It was, actually. I mean, the striking thing is not only the victory over slavery, but Haitians did create a very different society, a very kind of alternative society. I use the term counterplantation system. It's a term Jean Casimir, a Haitian sociologist, came up with to describe a system that was based on eliminating the plantation, refusing the plantation, and making sure that the plantation never came back. And in a certain way, Haitians have succeeded in doing that, although at cost and under great pressure from different forces.
And how early in Haiti history do we see what, even to this day, is this striking divide between the Haitian elite and the average Haitian citizen?
Well, that does actually begin even at the moment of the revolution, where some of the military leaders become large landowners. They sometimes use the military to kind of keep workers on the plantations. So you see a divide from the very beginning. It's also true, though, that that divide can sometimes be exaggerated, and there's always been a lot of complexity in Haitian social order that sometimes gets overlooked.
I know I'm jumping back and forth here a little bit, but there's another point about the birth of the country that I wanted to explore a little bit with you, and that, you know, is the fact that because the United States, because France, because Britain, all these nations looked, basically slaving nations, looked upon Haiti as this threat of you know, a country that whose slave populace freed themselves. That forced Haiti into basically an early cycle of militarism, did it not?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the French essentially were talking about reinvading, and they even had an occupation going in neighboring Santo Domingo, and they had troops there. So there was no doubt that Haitians were right, in a sense, to be worried about reoccupation. And the kind of language of the French was very violent towards them. So that did help to justify and kind of put a lot of money into building forts and the military early on. And it also did, I think, encourage a certain style of authoritarian governance that has, you know, always remained there at times.
Hmm. Now, I want to talk as much as we can about the multiple points in history of U.S. intervention in Haiti, but this deep history is fascinating. Apparently, President Washington, even, just after Haitian, the first revolt, sent arms to the country?
Well, the thing is that the U.S. has often had an ambiguous relationship with Haiti, partly because they wanted to trade with the country. And they did, in fact, trade with the country after 1804. So they didn't recognize its existence politically. But American traders very, very heavily traded with the country. And actually, during the revolution earlier, a lot of the weapons used to defeat the French had actually been purchased in the United States.
Have been purchased in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Or from the United States. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, there are also a series of economic consequences to the manner in which Haiti was born. And the one that I have to say kind of set me back on my heels most when I read in your book has to do with what France insisted that Haiti do in 1825. So this is, two decades after Haitian independence. What is it that the former enslaving nation of Haiti asked the Haitians to do?
Well, so France refused to recognize Haitian independence and essentially had a stranglehold over Haiti because other countries were going to follow France's lead in recognizing the country. And so in 1825, they essentially levied an indemnity on the country. So they said they would recognize Haitian independence, but Haiti would have to pay 150 million francs was the amount at that time. They would have to pay a kind of price, essentially. They'd have to pay their former masters for that recognition.
They'd have to pay for the recognition of being free.
So, I mean, I quote Louis-Joseph Janvier, a great Haitian intellectual of the 19th century, who sort of says Haitians had to pay for their land three times, you know, through the blood and sweat of being slaves, through the blood they spilled during the revolution. And then after all of that, once again, they had to still pay France for the right to be free.
And I mean, but it's a spectacular amount. I mean, you say that all the way up until 1914, as much as 80% of the Haitian's government budget went to paying France and French banks.
Well, by that time, actually, a lot of that has shifted to U.S. banks because by the late 19th century, U.S. banks begin to get into the sort of debt process. But they did pay off the original indemnity by the 1880s, so they had paid that. It took them about 60 years. But by that time, they had to take so many loans out in order to service that indemnity that, yes, they were locked in a kind of cycle of debt that has really never ended.
How? It's never ended. Okay, so that cycle of debt, I mean, is that one of the things that, you know, dating back 200 years now, that continues to really beleaguer the nation?
I think so. I mean, it's not an explanation for everything, but it certainly is the case that the Haitian state has been burdened since 1825 consistently by the need to service various foreign debts. And that has been very crippling for the country.
I'm sorry to just, I really want to pull out all the detail that you have in this book, because you even note that in 1825, 1830 time period, the French had put warships off the coast of Haiti just sort of to back up their threat that, you know, the Haitians had to pay.
Well, yeah, I mean, the deal was essentially they said you have to agree to this deal or else we're going to blockade your country and blockade trade. So there was definitely a military threat behind it. The issue, though, is also that the president, President Boyer, who is the Haitian president, did also agree to this in part because he thought that ultimately it would create more economic opportunities for the country. So I think the Haitian population was very against it, but certain members of the Haitian leadership did agree to it at the time, though certainly under threat from France.
Hmm. You do uncover some good news in Haiti's history, and I want to get to that. But first, let's get to a couple of listeners because we've got a phone bank full of calls here. We are speaking with Laurent Dubois. He's author of Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. A totally fascinating book. Let's get some questions. David is calling from Milford. You're on the air, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just curious, with Haiti being so prosperous under slavery, what's the driver behind the Haitian people not being able to coalesce and make their nation profitable as free men?
Thanks for the call, Dave. I mean, I suppose the question links to the fact that Haiti was and is a country of significant natural resources as well.
Yeah, and actually one of the surprises or something that people aren't familiar with in the book is that in the 19th century, Haiti actually did quite well economically. So this counterplantation system was based on creating food for internal consumption in these very complex markets, but also harvesting coffee and selling it into global markets. And that created a standard of living that was actually quite strong in Haiti in the 19th century. And you can see that because there was a great deal of migration to Haiti. Very few Haitians left the country. A lot of people actually moved to Haiti, including African Americans during that period. So in a way, there was an economically successful model in that period.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Professor Dubois, but tell us a little bit more about that. What was happening in Haiti in that part of the 19th century? Because you note that, I mean, even Germans or people from the Middle East were coming to Haiti because the economy was working so well in the 19th century.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't as profitable for outsiders as the slave plantation was. But on the other hand, it came with a measure of dignity, autonomy, and self-reliance that was very, very valuable, of course, to a population of ex-slaves. The coffee from Haiti was again being sold into the global markets. There was also dye wood being harvested, which did have consequences for deforestation, but was bringing profit into the country. And people, you know, had enough to eat. They had a pretty a very solid sort of secure food supply within the country. So all that meant that I say in the book, and I think this is true, that in the mid 19th century, if you looked around and to be a person of African descent in the Americas, Haiti was probably one of the best places to be compared to other countries where people continued under slavery or other forms of racial oppression.
But then if we fast forward a little bit to the beginning of the 20th century, particularly 1915, we see one of the most, I guess egregious is a fair word for this, moments of American intervention in Haiti. Tell us about what happened when the Marines landed in Haiti and why they first went there in 1915.
Well, it's part of obviously a broader history of intervention of the U.S. in the Caribbean in 1898 in Cuba and Puerto Rico and elsewhere, and there's occupation in the DR as well. But they land in 1915 partly with the excuse that there's been a great deal of political turmoil, and also fearing that German merchants in Haiti will be a threat in the beginning of the war, World War I. But that launches a 20-year occupation, which I argue has pretty profound and ultimately quite negative consequences for the country.
What was the real motivation for the United States? I mean, they said that there was a coup there that had destabilized the nation, but what was the real motivation?
Well, underneath there was essentially a kind of set of economic and strategic desires. Since the 1880s and 1890s, the U.S. had been eyeing a particular port in Haiti that's right across the peninsula from Guantanamo Bay, which is a very strategic port. That's a little a kind of area of the sea that leads straight to the Panama Canal. And there were also businessmen who really wanted to build railroads and rebuild plantations in Haiti.
So you've written in the book, though, that the occupation, which lasted 20 years, had quite a devastating effect on the country and a long-term devastation. I mean, there's these themes that may ring familiar to listeners today, everything from, the Marines not speaking any of the native Haitian languages to just the way in which the Haitian populace itself was treated. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Well, the Marines went in, at least the leadership and the government, with this idea of kind of reconstructing the state, of state building. But the idea of doing that revolved around kind of putting in large-scale plantations in the countryside, kind of balancing the budget, putting in a kind of new controlled system, a centralized government. But very quickly, they ran into a lot of resistance, precisely because what they wanted to put in place went very much against what Haitians wanted. And by 1918, there was widespread insurrection in the countryside and the beginning of a quite brutal two-year period of war that the Marines eventually won against these Haitian insurgents.
They eventually won it, but at what cost?
Well, it was a very kind of brutal war in the countryside. You had the use of aerial bombardment, which hadn't been used very much before, and the kind of destruction of a lot of rural communities. And in a sense, by the time that war had ended, the U.S. had essentially lost some of the support they had, because when they went in, as I show in the book, a lot of Haitian elites, in fact, welcomed or at least collaborated with the occupation, which is an important part of the story as well. But by the end of that war, that was essentially over with.
Well, on that note, let's take another call. Francie is calling from Mansfield. You're on the air, Francie.
Yes, I'm still here.
What's your thought today?
Well, what I'd like to add, I've been listening to Professor Dubois. In his book, he does have a great strategy of what happened in the past. It's affected the country big time. But right now, we have to concentrate on in the future right now. The way I look at it is that when a Haitian born elsewhere, or they go to their country, automatically they create a name for those Haitians. The name diaspora. I don't think it's fair for the Haitian that live abroad have a title on the name. It's called the diaspora. I got my kids that was born in Haiti. Automatically they are Haitian. And I with American passport and American birth certificate. See, American do not lose their blood. The French do not lose their blood. So the Canadians.
So Francie, are you saying that members of the diaspora should return to Haiti, or what is it? What's the point that you're trying to make about dual citizenship?
Dual citizenship means they should look at Haitian as is. If your mother is Haitian, your father is Haitian, even if you were born in the United States, automatically you are American. You are also Haitian, and like the French, the dual citizenship is in favor of our country in Haiti.
Francie, I think I take your point, and thank you so much for your call. Professor Dubois, you hear Francie there, I mean, basically talking about the fact that there is such a profound Haitian diaspora. We're benefits of that here in Boston by having this wonderful Haitian community here. Many members of the diaspora were spread out, I believe, following that U.S. intervention in 1915. From your recent trip to Haiti, do you still see, tensions there between those who left and those who have stayed? That may stretch out over a century?
Well, there certainly are tensions and differences and people who've grown up in different parts of the world and have different experiences. I do think the diaspora has a very important role to play in Haiti and is playing a very important role in Haiti. I also think that both Haitian policies and U.S. policies could be changed to facilitate the positive role that the diaspora could play. So absolutely, in the 21st century, that's going to be a really, really crucial issue for Haiti and hopefully can be one of the sources of positive change.
Let's take another call. David is calling from Hyde Park. You're on the air, David.
Yes, good afternoon. I hear this is sort of a one-sided conversation. I'd like the guests to discuss the billions of dollars that have gone into Haiti over the last few years from former colonial powers.
David, thank you so much for your call. Absolutely. I mean, Professor Dubois, it's not all just the evil West having breathed down Haiti's neck for so long. You actually do write about money in great detail in the book. So your answer to David's question about foreign aid.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that happens after the U.S. occupation is that you get a change and a kind of different way of thinking about how to approach Haiti. Starting in the 40s and 50s, a lot of aid projects and development projects with different governments, and I certainly explore that in the book. There is a kind of broad question, though, to be asked about, how effective that money has been. If money has been spent, why hasn't it had produced better results? And I think it's a question, a lot of soul searching is going on, too, among people who work in Haiti. Paul Farmer, in his recent book, and and others about, you know, what could be done better. But no doubt, both France and the United States have sent aid. But it's still, I think there's a lot to be asked about exactly how and whether that process has been as effective as it could be.
Well, you mentioned Paul Farmer, and let me ask you about that. I mean, he's, of course, Dr. Paul Farmer, who's head of Partners in Health, Boston-based organization that's done some pretty amazing medical work in Haiti. Do you think that they are representative of a different kind of American intervention, a new kind of maybe cooperation, rather, with Haiti that's emerged in the past 20 or 30 years that may be different than the various governmental interventions we've seen in the past 200 years?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, Partners in Health is definitely, you know, built on a completely different ideology and a completely different basis from earlier U.S. Projects. It's about collaboration and about capacity building within Haiti. That's the whole point of it. And they, you know, largely work with Haitian staff. So that obviously promises a very different kind of relationship. I would encourage, you know, listeners, though, to read Paul Farmer's recent book, Haiti After the Earthquake, where he also really, you know, puts a self-critical gaze not so much on Partners in Health, precisely, but on the bigger configuration and the limits of a configuration that may be not addressing all the issues that it needs to address.
You know, I want to circle back to this idea that there have been some long-held stereotypes and beliefs about Haiti that date all the way back to where and how the nation was born. But this circle takes us actually to just last week to Davos at the World Economic Forum, where Haitian President Michel Martelly spoke. I have a little tape of that, so let's listen.
I came here mainly to tell you that the old Haiti that you've been hearing about, the images that you've been seeing, this Haiti is all over now. This new leadership is about no more aid but trade, no more handouts but hands up.
So that he goes on to basically say that Haiti's open and ready for business and looking for direct investment. But it was that idea there that he said the old Haiti doesn't exist anymore. I mean, moving forward from your deep expertise in the history of this country, how much of this history does Haiti have to shed before it can move forward?
Well, I think I think that the history has both positives and negatives, right? Mm-hmm. So the point of analyzing history would be to see what are the things in the past that actually have worked, and there are things that have worked. What are the kind of aspirations that Haitians have developed through their history, right, that are historically constituted and that are completely justified, and how to make those come true, and also what forces have stopped those from coming true. I would argue that actually there's a lot in Haitian history that is precisely a great foundation for the future, and we need to know about that just as much as we need to analyze the difficulties and conflicts and failures. So that would be my take on that.
Well, that is Professor Laurent Dubois. He is author of the new book, Haiti, the Aftershocks of History. He's a professor of Romance Studies and History at Duke University. Professor Dubois, thank you so much for your time and for your amazing book. It was really a pleasure to read. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And listeners, let us know what you think. We're at radioboston.org. Up next, safe sex. Easier said than done. We take a closer look in our Common Health segment. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.